Today I want to talk about the general relativistic theory of cosmological perturbations, and I'll try to discuss both the classical theory of relativistic cosmological perturbations and also the quantum theory. Now, to set the framework, I have a space-time diagram of inflationary cosmology, time, space, the Hubble radius, and this indicates a fixed comoving scale, comoving scale corresponding to scales that we observe today. Now, these scales were outside of the Hubble radius for most of their cosmological evolution. They only entered the Hubble radius fairly recently. The Newtonian theory is applicable at late times. This is the domain of validity of the Newtonian theory. This is the domain of validity of the classical relativistic theory. And if you want to understand the origin of fluctuations, namely this part, you will need a quantum theory. Now, the quantum theory and the classical theory is one unified framework, so you don't have to worry about this transition. So you see that for inflationary cosmology, during most of the evolution, you need the relativistic theory because you're dealing with scales larger than the Hubble radius. So now, why should perturbations grow? So first comes this preview. And in this preview, I want to argue that metric fluctuations can grow even if the wavelength is larger than the Hubble radius. And to show that, I'll give you a pseudo argument. Let's just look at the Friedmann equation. Energy density, Hubble expansion rate squared. Now let's imagine that we have a long wavelength density fluctuation, which means that rho is a function of x. Rho varies very slowly, but if you take patches of the universe more than one Hubble length apart, rho is different. The fact that rho is different means that the Hubble expansion rate is different, which means that the metric perturbation is growing. So from this equation, I will argue that metric fluctuations grow on super Hubble scales. And there's no causality violation.
Why only on super Hubble scales?
No, they go in particular on super Hubble scales. They also grow on sub Hubble scales. You can use the Newtonian theory to discuss it. But no, you shouldn't say that they don't grow on super Hubble scales. So they grow also. Are you happy with that? Also on super Hubble scales.
Yeah, no, just so your argument means that on any scale that rho varies, the metric perturbation goes.
Right. Right.
Why would the expansion be different if you are looking at distances larger than one?
The expansion, well, h is measurable. Your expansion rate is measurable.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that you have a metric fluctuation. This metric fluctuation will produce fluctuations in the locally measurable expansion rate. That's kind of the pseudo argument that I'm giving. So
Bob, what's wrong with intuition that if you're talking super Hubble, it's outside the scale of causality?
Right. So again, that's what I was just going to say.
Okay.
There's no violation of causality at all because let's imagine that this is the beginning of inflation, T sub I, beginning of inflation. Let's assume that the period before inflation was radiation dominated. In that case, the horizon, namely the forward dipole, was approximately equal to the Hubble radius. But the horizon, maybe the forward dipole, expands exponentially. At the end of inflation, it's exponentially larger than the Hubble radius. So this is the causality limit. And we will be speaking only about scales which are smaller than the causality limit, simply because on scales larger than the causality limit, we don't know what initial conditions to choose. So nowhere in here, everything is in the causal domain. So key thing is that in anything but an ordinary power law expanding universe, Hubble radius and horizon are very different. Okay, so You know, this preview is very hand-wavy, it's so hand-wavy that I eliminate it right now.
So before you do this, before...
Eliminate it.
Can I ask one more? So, if you're saying that the expansions depend on scales are separated by longer than the hand-wavies, then does it mean that you can observe that?
You can observe that? For, you wait until the scales enter the Hubble radius, then you can observe it. So you see what happens is, let me give a preview on the physics. What will happen in inflation is that you have quantum vacuum fluctuations which produce minute fluctuations in the metric. Order of magnitude 10 to the minus 20 here. Self-gravity amplifies these so that they enter the Hubble radius today with order of magnitude 1. And that, those are the perturbations which we are observing. We are measuring this the fact that if there had been no amplification, we wouldn't have seen anything. In the first paper that on fluctuations in inflationary cosmology, which was written in the United States, did not take into account this amplification, and therefore predicted that inflation would produce fluctuations of the order of magnitude 10 to the minus 20, as opposed to 1.
Like
the moving part paper? No. No. They okay, one of the
truths. Is the reason you erase that so quickly because it gives the wrong sign?
Yes, it's.
It seemed like if there's higher density, you get a higher expansion. That would tend to. You would think that would tend to.
Yeah.
You know, if I dilute it more rapidly, so it would tend. It looks like it's a damping term rather than.
Yeah, right. So I just want to show you that there is some dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
The equations will come. The equations will come here. Okay. So now what I won't write down is, again, the overall framework. Because the overall framework is very similar to what we are doing in the classical theory, in the classical Newtonian theory. We have a background. We do linear perturbations about this background. So at the level of the equations of motion, we're looking at linear fluctuations. The background is the Friedman-Robinson-Walker background. Background. ds squared is a squared eta. Eta squared minus eta. Eta I've defined here as conformal time. So dt is a d eta. This is the physical time, this is conformal time. This is the background, and now what we will be doing is we will be looking. This object is g mu d zero, metric g mu zero plus delta g. So you see, we have to track the metric fluctuations. Now, you would think that this problem is very difficult because we have to track 10 degrees of freedom. It's a symmetric tensor, there are 10 degrees of freedom in four dimensional space-time. So let me start talking about classification. So even though we are doing linearized theory, you could imagine that we are going to end up with an extremely complicated linearized theory because we have 10 metric degrees of freedom plus map. So let's take the map to be simple, a scalar field. So, superficially, it looks like we have 11 degrees of freedom. I'm going to reduce the discussion to 1 degree of freedom. I'll be showing that using the correct classification, physical study of what the different modes mean, and by taking into account the fact that x and eta are not physical, they're just coordinates. We don't measure coordinates, we have to express things in coordinate invariant way. We can reduce everything to 1 degree of freedom. So see, this classification and gauge transformation is kind of a little bit involved. But what you gain is a reduction from 11 degrees of freedom to 1 degree of freedom.
How do we do that? Because usually you get 2 degrees of freedom for the gravitational field after taking the time.
You see, the 2 degrees of freedom which you are thinking of are the two gravitational wave polarizations.
Well, it's always
okay. Now, no, Let's wait to see how I classify them.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say that gravitational waves are trivial, they don't couple to the matter, and I'm not going to going to study them separately. So see that the classification is I'll will basically factor out the gravitational waves, and it will consider the part of the fluctuations that couple to matter separately.
But the counting of the degrees of freedom doesn't have necessarily anything to do with gravitational waves. You can do that.
Yes, but
locally.
you get.
You must make some additional assumptions. But I will wait.
Yes, you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you said that let's keep matter simple and look at the scalar field. But I mean, at least in hindsight, we need to have some argument to explain why we were able to do that. Why spinner and vector fields, the other ones that are there in nature, did not get amplified.
Okay, so in fact, they do get amplified. So you see now if you in reality, our matter sector is complicated. We have many matter fields, so there are many degrees of freedom, not just one. But all of the other degrees of freedom come from the complicated matter structure. So now, for one scalar field, you can reduce the study of the cosmological perturbations, the metric perturbations that have linearized order coupled to matter. You can reduce it to one degree of freedom, but we know that matter consists of many fields, and that means that you have to be a little bit careful. It's not true that only one component grows. If you have two matter fields, both of which are relevant in the early universe, then you have 2 degrees of freedom which can grow, even on supermassive scales.
Well, if both are scalar, you mean?
Even if both are. The fact that they are scalar is not all that important, I think. The only thing that I've studied is systems where you treat matter degrees of freedom as scalar fields.
Right, but I mean, I just want that essentially for the same reason that you would probably soon explain that the vector fluctuations are not as important as the tensor and scalar ones. Essentially for the same reason all the spinners and other vectors are not.
No, because I can construct an energy density from spinner fields and from gauge fields. And the energy density behaves like the energy density of a scalar field. It's a scalar, it couples to a scalar metric degree of freedom.
So
it's not true that, for example, vector fields only couple to vector perturbations, vector gravitational perturbations, which I'll introduce in a moment. So spinner fields, spinner matter fields, and gauge matter fields are cosmological perturbations, and they can grow.
So we should consider them as part of what goes into the definition of the inflator field, as far as the overall fluctuations go?
Right, so if you do inflationary cosmology and you only consider one matter field, then you assume that it's only one matter field in the matter sector which is really dominant. And if your theory, if this is a valid assumption from the point of view of the matter sector, then for example in spin models you have many matter fields which can be important. At a similar level, if you only treat 1 degree of freedom, you are missing many important physical effects. You're missing exponential instabilities, which can happen here reheating. But let's postpone those discussions. Let's do the simple case first. One matter field.
This is almost the same question, but a perfect fluid is presumably a better approximation to the nature of matter in the period that you're talking about than a scalar field. So how much difference does that make?
Well, see, the way that I know how to get inflation
is this during inflation or after? I thought this was after inflation.
No, I want to discuss fluctuations from the beginning, from the initial periods of inflation until where they re-enter the Hubble orbits. During and after inflation, in a consistent framework. But in particular, during
inflation. This is not this transfer function or whatever people call it.
No, the transfer function that has the transfer function, what people call the transfer function, that's something I did not discuss in the last lecture. That's part of the Newtonian theory, cosmological perturbations. I can explain that to you in private.
Okay, but at the end of the last lecture, you had made some comments that seemed to depend on understanding this later period in which the period between matter radiation equality and
But you mean reionization. But that's not the transfer function. That's something.
So is that included in this? What we're doing now? Is that period included?
Now that came from a coupling of different matter fields. Is that, that was baryons versus Kulldock matter.
Yeah, right.
And so what I'm going to discuss here is like, is more just appropriate to Kulldock matter.
So I want to ask a follow-up question related to those. So if we just consider one scalar field, it means we believe that the sectors of cosmological history that we're looking at, that's the only matter that's important.
Mm-hmm.
And basically for vector fields, however many there are, spinners, mm-hmm. if we believe they are important at that era, they should all be included distinctly, and so we would have a multi-inflaton gauge field, etc. type. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so it's but only for reasons of computational simplicity at this stage that people tend to use one scalar.
Yes, for computational simplicity, plus the idea that we want to apply this to inflation. And in inflation, the idea is that all matter is redshifted away except for the inflaton field. So therefore, the only field that's important.
Okay, so there is a contention physically that the inflaton is the only thing that matters, because
That's the way that you would argue. However, that argument is false, because any field which during inflation is overdamped will not decay away. But these are all questions which are kind of on advanced topics. So I'd like to come back to the development of the theory. So the goal is to get from 11 degrees of freedom to 1 degree of freedom. And you see, if we now make a preview about what the quantum theory of cosmological perturbations will be, we're doing linearized theory. In linearized theory, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with a quadratic action. If we can reduce the problem to one variable, and we invert the usual order of doing things, namely we first fix the coordinate system and then we quantize, then you know from the beginning that we will have reduced the entire problem of quantizing cosmological perturbations to the quantization of a single free scalar field. And that's an extremely easy problem. The only complication is that this free scalar field might have a mass which depends on the background. So you see where I'm heading. So instead of having 11 interacting quantum fields to quantize, we will have a single quantum field to quantize. So that's where we're heading. Okay, so the classification principle. Is under spatial rotations. How do the various, so that's a classification principle. The behavior of various quantities under spatial rotations. So there are scalar quantities which behave as scalars under such spatial rotations, and for example, the G00 component, which I call phi, that's a scalar quantity. And then you can construct a vector which sits in the 0i metric component by taking the gradient of a scalar. So B is a function of space and time. And then there's a spatial diagonal. And then you can also take a scalar and construct a spatial tensor by taking two derivatives. These are ordinary partial derivatives, provided that I'm taking a spatial background, which is just Euclidean space. If I do a spatial background, which is non-trivial, then these derivatives here would be the covariant derivatives with respect to the spatial.
That's already a restricted ANDERS.
Right, so these are now 4 degrees of freedom out of the 10 degrees of freedom. So 4 transform as scalars, and now there are other, there are vectors and tensors. So, I'm not making a restricted ansatz here, I'll just be separated out, I'll have 4 plus 4 plus 2, and then I'll argue which ones are important. So, there are vector perturbations, and, well, actually, I will also just decide to multiply the term metric by the scale factor, which is convention. I'll do that for the vector perturbations as well. Now, a vector mode is the trace is the traceless part of a vector. And so if I take a vector Si, which is traceless, then those are 2 degrees of freedom which transform as vectors under spatial rotations. And then I can also take a vector and I can construct a space-space tensor by taking the partial derivatives, and once again I take the vector to be divergences. 4 degrees of freedom.
That
Si
column,
and Fi are functions.
That column is not supposed to be there in the lower left, right? You've got S comma
it,
I.
It's supposed to be there in the upper right.
Is it?
Oh, no, you're right.
It's not supposed, supposed to be there.
You're right. It's not supposed to be there.
Thanks.
But when you say traceless for a vector, you mean divergenceless.
Thanks. And then finally, there are the tensor perturbations. And these are the usual gravitational waves with 2 polarization states. So those are the ones that you're all familiar with. And they live in the spatial part. And it's a transverse traceless H. I'll just write TT, transverse traceless, 2 degrees of freedom. So now at linearized, if we just do the linear theory of cosmological perturbations, then scalar perturbations, vector perturbations, and tensor perturbations evolve independently. No coupling between the two at linear order. So we can analyze them separately. Now, gravitational waves don't couple to matter. So they're easy to analyze. They don't evolve trivially. They don't just oscillate back and forth, they also grow in time. But the analysis is trivial compared to the analysis of the scalar metric fluctuation. So I'll treat the difficult case. I'll be focusing on scalar one. Now the vector perturbations in an expanding universe decay away. It's like a vector is corresponds, builds up a flux, expansion dilutes the flux. So therefore vector perturbations decay away. So in an expanding universe, you're not interested in vector perturbations. However, if you have a different cosmological scenario in which you have a phase of contraction followed by a phase of expansion, you can't neglect the vector perturbations. They are routinely neglected.
What about isocurvature perturbations?
Now, isocurvature perturbations are relative perturbations in different matter components. So they arise if you have more than one component of matter. Okay, you mentioned, you had this question about 2 degrees of freedom. I think the 2 degrees of freedom that you were talking about were these ones here.
I usually go, you gauge the other ones away.
Right, but you cannot gauge the other ones away if you have matter, because they are physical. You can eliminate them, you can kind of replace them by matter degrees of freedom, as you will see. So now, okay, gauging them away. I'm going to gauge them away. I'm going to gauge some of them away. So it will turn out that I can gauge away two of these and two of these. But in principle, I still have two physical scalar perturbations, two physical vector perturbations, and two tensor perturbations. So let's...
You can gauge away four because you have four coordinates invariants.
Four coordinates at the legalized level. So if
and, and you also have four constraints.
Yes. I'll be using all of them.
Okay.
So, if unless there are any other questions about classification, I'll turn to the gauge transformations.
Well, I'm confused by like Thomas's question, because if you take scalar plus gravity, then you would say four. Two for gravity and two for this. Or even one. One if you count that way, one for gravity.
Whatever. So I would guess that the S
that you would end up with three. But in fact, you had more than three.
Let's see how many I'll get. So, so now again, we are looking at linear perturbations. We are looking only at small space-time transformations, infinitesimal space-time transformations. So x mu prime equals x mu plus z prime mu. 4 quadratic degrees of freedom. Of those, two are scalar, namely psi 0, and two are vector, and the psi I have to write as something that's divergenceless plus psi comma I. So the function, I take its gradient, that provides one scalar degree of freedom, then there's a divergenceless part, that's 2 degrees of freedom. These are the two vectors. And this is the size of scalar. So, therefore, I can gauge away two of these scalar degrees of freedom, and I can gauge away two of these vector degrees of freedom. Okay, so now, what you can do, and that's an exercise, given this coordinate transformation, you can work out how these variables transform, phi, b, psi, and e. You get transformation words. So that's, you can read what the answer is. The answer is not important. I guess what's more important, let me eliminate now the vector perturbations and the tensor perturbations, because I won't discuss them anymore. You have two choices to proceed further at the classical level. You can either define gauge invariant variables. Or you can completely fix the gauge. So let me write down a basis of gauge invariant variables. So once you know how the four variables transform, once you find out how phi, b, psi, and e transform, then it's a simple linear algebra problem to find out to find the combinations of these four variables, which are invariant. That's obviously simple linear algebra exercise. And the answer is that it's this combination which is invariant. Prime is the derivative with respect to conformal time. So prime is d by d eta. So this is invariant under such a coordinate transformation. And another variable which is invariant is
invariant under what?
These are invariant under infinitesimal coordinate transformations of scalar type generated by a psi 0 and xi. Good, so basically if we use gauge invariant variables, what we have to do is we have to write out the equation for motion. And the equation of motion, in principle, are straightforward. It's the perturbation of the Einstein tensor equals h pi g, perturbation in T union. We just take all of these equations. We plug in the ansatz for the perturbed metric and for the perturbed matter, for scalar perturbations only. And we write out all of these equations. We express all of these equations in terms of these gauge invariant variables. And after a lot of algebra, but absolutely straightforward, then you get a set of equations.
So the reason you can find these two gauge invariant quantities is because you are expanding around h bar. So presumably they have some expression in terms of the original delta g.
I mean, right. In fact, I'm going to illustrate the relationship by introducing a special gauge. So, if you, for example, fix a gauge, I'll just say example, longitudinal gauge. And longitudinal gauge is defined by setting b equals 0. And setting E equals 0. That's the longitudinal gauge. So you see that in longitudinal gauge, my gauge invariant variables are simply the diagonal components of the metric. So in longitudinal gauge, the metric is diagonal, including perturbations. And that's a gauge that's simple to work with. Because now if you fix the gauge, insert the restricted ansatz into the equations of motion, it is very easy to derive the equation, to derive your final equations.
Then you have to look at the original action of the scalar field 2 in this equation. Because here you only vary with respect to g.
That's right. You know that the continuity equation is degenerate with one of the with the Bianchi identities. So you know that the scalar field equation of motion is contained in here. So you don't have to consider that separately. When I do the quantum theory, I will explicitly take into account. So
I'm having trouble coming up with a sort of firm argument why, first of all, why the tensor and so on, vector perturbations don't couple to matter. And second of all, why these perturbations don't couple to each other. I mean, I can see that they, in some sense, belong to different representations of something, but I can't quite figure out what that something is.
Now that
you see what I mean.
Right. See, if you have matter, for example, a scalar field, you cannot construct, and the scalar field is a homogeneous isotropic background field plus some linear perturbations, then at linear order, there's nothing in the delta Tij sector that couples to gravitational waves. So, and also you know that in vacuum you have gravitational waves. So you know that those 2 degrees of freedom are independent of the matter. So you see that both explicitly in terms of looking at, but the statement is only true at linearized level.
Yeah, sure.
That's for the tensor fluctuations?
For the tensor fluctuations. The vector perturbations do couple to matter, but it's a decaying mode. So I'm not considering the vector perturbations simply because I'm not interested in things that decay in expanded universe.
And is there a back of the envelope argument as to why they decay?
That's a flux. See, if you have matter, a vector perturbation, the matter corresponds to a flux. If you have an expanding background, the flux gets diluted.
Oh, the flux gets killed off. Okay. Whereas the scalar bones don't.
Scalar bones don't. Because there's self-gravity.
Yeah.
Self-gravitational amplification.
But can we see, maybe you don't want to go into this detail, but can we see, for example, why the tensor bones won't couple to matter and the hydrogen bones will in some simple way?
I could do that, but I would prefer to show this explicitly, to show something equivalent when I eliminate one further scalar bone. So instead of showing that explicitly, I'll show explicitly why, with simple matter, I can kill off one further scalar degree of freedom. So I've discussed the classification, the gauge transformations. So those are that's the difficult stuff in terms of the relativistic theory of cosmological perturbations. So I kind of invite questions on that, because what I'm going to do here is I'm going to just say some words on how one derives equations in principle. And in practice, it's exactly what I did in Newtonian theory. It's just a little bit more, there are more equations to deal with.
So here you're discussing the modes that grow, the perturbations that grow. So
however, the tensor perturbations grow as well.
Right, but...
But they grow more in inflation cosmology.
But for any of them, if they grow, then the linearized approximation breaks down.
Yes.
And then they will start mixing.
That's right. That's right. But now, in response to that, I will say that we observe today the fluctuations, relative fluctuations, smaller than order unity on large scales. Since perturbations grow, we have gravitational instability. That means that in the past history, they were always small. The linearized approximation was always valid. So you are right that as soon as the perturbations become order unity, the linearized approximation breaks down, and then you'll never be able to suppress the fluctuations, make them linear again. And you'll have all this complicated mode mixing. But if we are interested in the microwave anisotropy measurements and on scales corresponding to superclusters of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, we don't have to worry about it.
So all the way from the beginning of inflation till now, you're saying that data have always been within the linear approximation?
That's right. So the only case where you actually get...
So we've been very lucky.
Yes, we've been very lucky. And you see, that's part...
Maybe that's entropic principle.
No? Well, that's a good question. We've been very lucky. That's the homogeneity problem of standard Debye cosmology. Why is the universe so homogeneous? That's that problem. Inflation provides us possible solution to that, because it is a vacuum cleaner for it, redshifts all pre-existing inhomogeneities. So see, inflation does produce the initial conditions which you can then analyze. So this kind of a consistent picture. Okay. Okay, so what we do now is we can do the boring part of the job, namely to derive the equations of motion. So what we do is we have our background, our ansatz for the metric perturbations. We stick this into these equations of motion, like we did in Newtonian theory. In Newtonian theory, we had Newtonian equations of motion, we had a background, we had perturbations, we We stuck the ansatz for background perturbations into the equations of motion. We got a whole set of first order differential equations. Then we combined two of those equations to get a second order differential equation. We did the same thing here. And after a lot of algebra, but none of it is, it's absolutely straightforward, you end up with a set of equations. I'm writing them down in longitudinal gauge. You don't have to write these equations down, except for the last one. Prime is always derivative with respect to conformal time. So mistake. Zero. So that's, these are principal constraint equations and dynamical equations. A new symbol, D, where D is phi minus psi. Derivative, upper index I, lower index J. So, the only equation which I want to look at is now this equation, this third equation. I want to look at the components which are I not equal to J. And I want to take matter which has no anisotropic stress. For example, a single scalar field or several scalar fields. You cannot construct terms linear in the perturbations which have I not equal to J. I not equal to J, you have delta Tij equals zero. Because you need to have two spatial derivatives of a scalar field to construct something which is which resides in delta Tij. So this vanishes at linear order, and therefore you conclude, since perturbations vanish in space average, one further degree of freedom eliminated. So now what we have, so this is if we have no anisotropic stress, then we get this. So 2 degrees of freedom. Two scalar degrees of freedom left, namely phi and delta phi. Matter perturbation, matter perturbation. But they are coupled together by this equation. They are not independent either. One degree of freedom left if you want to discuss scalar metric fluctuations. And I guess that's what you meant, Thomas, when you said that you can eliminate all of these scalar degrees of freedom, because the number of scalar degrees of freedom we are left with is a number of independent matter scalar degrees of freedom. And now, Raphael, this kind of logic, you see, where I argue that delta Tij will vanish you can use the same argument to show that that the thing that couples to gravitational waves has no components at the linearized order.
So I guess here you use the fact that not more than first derivatives occur in the stress energy vector pi. So to get two derivatives,
right,
you need two derivatives, and that can only be quadratically, right, and so it vanishes in the narrator. But if we had fluid with pressure, I don't think that would be right.
That's right, because then it's possible to
then
get
anisotropics.
You can get anisotropics.
Then you have, even if it's isotropic, but I see. Never mind. I'm just looking at the off-diagonal components for this argument.
Okay, so now what you can do is once you've eliminated the sixth degree of freedom, you have one less, you can combine the equations to get the final equation of motion. So the last step is always combination of two of the first order differential equations. And this combination gives an equation which is important. So this equation is important. Phi double prime plus 2h minus phi naught double prime over phi naught prime, phi prime minus del square phi equals plus 2h prime minus h phi naught double prime over phi naught prime phi equals 0. So this gives you the classical equation of motion, which describes the growth of scalar metric fluctuations in an expanded background in the case where matter is a scalar field. So let's look at this. What I want to do now is I want to look at this result. I want to eliminate all these public equations here, which are the intermediate results. And I want to interpret all of these terms physically and show you that there are very few surprises compared to the Newtonian theory. So, acceleration is given by a combination of forces. This is pressure, which causes oscillations. Remember, in the Newtonian theory, if you had a matter which had pressure, then on small scales you had oscillations and fluctuations. This is pressure. And this pressure leads you to oscillations on small scales. This term here is the gravitational self-force. Remember that in Newtonian theory I argued that delta rho double dot is proportional to g delta rho. That's this term, self-gravitational term. On scales where this term is more important than this term, you'll get an instability. Gravitational perturbations grow. The whole system is in an expanding background. This is Hubble damping. We have this in the Newtonian theory as well. So I see that the terms of all, that this equation is very similar in structure to the Newtonian theory. You can see what all of these terms do. So, this equation describes the growth of scalar cosmological perturbations. It is similar in structure to the Newtonian perturbation equations. It's a linear equation. You Fourier expand, each Fourier mode evolves independently. Two solutions for each Fourier mode, like in the Newtonian theory. Oscillatory solutions on small length scales. Growing solutions on large scales. The growing solutions will be power law growth because there's a damping term, and so on. So that's one thing that I want to stress, is that at the end of the day, we see that the physics of the perturbation equation gives you what we should expect. It gives us exactly the generalization of what we know has to happen to the relativistic regime.
Provided delta Tij is zero.
Yeah. For I not equal to j.
Yes.
For I not equal to j. So now, let's look at the special case. And I want to look at the special case where the equation of state is constant in time. And that means that H prime vanishes and the state of field is at rest. So then we find that the gravitational growth term vanishes. And therefore we find that the dominant mode of phi constant in time. That's a result, and that's a result that you can only get in a relativistic theory. So if you have a fixed background, sorry, a fixed equation of state, for example, you have a radiation-dominated universe, you look at perturbations on super Hubble scales, you find that the dominant mode of the scalar metric fluctuation is constant. There is a decay mode. So the only way that you get the growth of the metric fluctuation is when the equation of state changes. Now, in inflationary cosmology, the equation of state changes.
Sorry, I got confused. I thought H is the Hubble. What is H?
Thanks for this curly H is the A prime over A.
Okay.
So it is A times the Hubble expansion of the physical Hubble expansion.
You've made no assumptions about del squared on phi. You got that?
Last year's. That's right. Nice. Large scales means scales where this term is negligible.
Well, there's something really, I guess, intriguing about the self-gravity term as compared to the Dunning-Damping term. You seem to get like this some enhancement from an extra H in the self-gravity.
But you can argue that just by dimensional analysis. There has to be an extra H now, just to make the dimensions fit. So I don't think there's anything subtle there.
Isn't that mode in some sense a pure gauge mode, that one that's constant?
It's not, because we've eliminated the gauge least freedom.
Well, what does it mean physically? It sounds like you just should change the zero of time a little bit in order to get that mode. You just have radiation domination.
Now, actually, what you find is that the time translation is gives rise to decay mode. A decay mode which has a different decay, which has a different power of decay than the second mode here. So this constant mode is a physical mode.
So what does it mean? I mean, suppose you're dealing with radiation domination, then you just say heat the universe up a little bit. That presumably, I mean, that'll change the density, so I presume that that's equivalent to a constant phi.
Yes, but
the density was, but if you just go back a little in time, it's spatially flat, so if you just go back, oh, I see, but you've changed the couple. No, I don't get it. I mean, if you just go back a little in time, you'll be in that situation, that very situation.
Yeah, but, so what you do is you say, let's make a time translation, t prime is equal to t plus delta t.
Yeah.
And let's look at how this does that affect the what kind of delta G is produced. it induces something in the phi, a contribution to phi, before gauge fixing, but that contribution decays as punctual power.
Okay, but then what?
This is, this corresponds to the following. You have a mass perturbation, an inhomogeneous mass distribution, that creates the gravitational potential between them. And locally measured at quantum space, this gravitational perturbation is not growing as punctual power.
Oh, okay. That's I only meant in the limit of zero wavelength. I mean, infinite wavelength. It's pure gauge. You're saying for large but finite wavelength, it's not pure gauge.
Yes, that's right. That's what I'm saying, exactly. Okay. So therefore, if you imagine that you have a universe in which the early stages are described by the same equation of state as our present universe, and you want to start out with quantum fluctuations, which are minute in magnitude, you'll never get large fluctuations. So the only reason why in inflationary cosmology you get large fluctuations today is that the equation of state changes. So the second special case is inflation, scalar field driven inflation. In this case, the equation of state is changing. So now, in order to see what happens, we can actually take this equation and we can rewrite it as in this form. We have zeta dot times h times 1 plus w is equal to 0 plus order del square phi. So if you look at large scales on which spatial gradients are negligible in the equation of motion, then this equation of motion is equivalent to a conservation law, which says that zeta dot times h times 1 plus w is 0. Zeta is constant provided 1 plus w is not 0. W is pressure divided by energy density. And this zeta is a cleverly chosen combination of phi in its first derivative. Dot is derivative with respect to physical time. So you see, what I'm doing is I'm introducing a trick, a pseudo-conservation law, and rephrasing this equation of motion as a pseudo-conservation law will make it very easy to apply this equation to inflationary cosmology. Phi dot square minus v. Energy density is 1/2 phi dot square plus v. During inflation, v is much larger than phi dot. So therefore, w is almost just a little bit bigger than minus 1. This is humiliating. After inflation, all of the energy goes into radiation. Radiation has an equation of state, W equals 1/3. So this is the way that W behaves in an inflationary cosmology. So at late times, phi is constant, because at late times, the equation of state is not changing. At early times, phi is constant. So what we want to do is we want to say that zeta at late times, f stands for final, is equal to zeta at t initial. And at t initial and at t final, phi dot vanishes. 1 plus w, 1 divided by 1 plus w is huge during inflation. So effectively, you find that that phi at t final is equal to phi at t initial divided by 1 plus w at t final divided by 1 plus w at t initial. And I think there's a factor of 2/3 of 3 over 2, which I'm missing here. So this relates the final amplitude of the metric fluctuation long after inflation on large scales to the initial value of the metric fluctuation when the fluctuations exit the Hubble radius. And this is the formula which you should apply to inflationary cosmology. So if you invent a new formula for a new model of inflation and you want to calculate the fluctuations, don't use a magic formula from some textbook, but use this formula. Because magic formulas from particular older textbooks, they tend not to be valid. They tend to be valid only in limited range of models.
Well, when I read the notes and stuff, the original one, I mean, Slavin, Feldman, and I saw this parameter, I would have never guessed it. This transformation.
You mean this definition?
Yeah. What's the insight? I mean.
You know, lately you can ask, what does this quantity mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And physically, this actually, and you see, we found this by playing around.
Yeah.
So you know that there's some combination of phi and phi dot, and which has the property that zeta dot is equal to zero, but that's equivalent to recirculating motion. You know that. We just played around and found this combination. It turns out that this is the curvature perturbation of the co-moving gauge.
But you started out in like a longitudinal gauge,
yeah.
And now you can relate this to a completely different gauge invariant variable.
Right. So therefore, in order to get physical insight onto why fluctuations grow and how, this longitudinal gauge is not the best gauge. It's the simplest gauge to do the algebra, but it's not the physically most transparent gauge. There are singularities that appear in the longitudinal gauge, which don't appear if you go to the co-moving gauge.
Is that what the parabolic situation was in analyzing?
So let me tell a story. If you look at the preprint of the first paper that was written, using this formalism, using the parabolistic formalism to work out fluctuations, phi was just considered to be constant from the beginning to the end because this jump was not taken into account. And therefore you got, so what you did is you said, well, we have this zone of ignorance, this region of ignorance. We don't know how reheating occurs. Therefore what we will do is we will just analyze the equation of motion here, analyze the equation of motion here, and patch together the solution continuously, phi continuous at the transition. If you do that, in inflation, you get 20 orders of magnitude wrong. In the paper of September 2002, on fluctuations in the ekpyrotic scenario, it is proposed to do exactly this kind of matching for the ekpyrotic scenario. It's proposed to match phi, this variable phi, continuously across this region of ignorance. Whereas what David Langith did on a paper that appeared around the same time, as he said, no, we should match this one continuously. Then we obviously get different results.
I just have a silly point of arithmetic. If you conserve phi, if you conserve zeta, and phi dot is zero initially and finally, aren't you going to get a 2 plus w over 1 plus w factor on each side? Maybe I see the brackets wrong, but
no, there is a I said that there's a number here.
No, but it seems you get more than that. It looks like if I just put things to a common denominator, I get 2 plus w over 1 plus w times phi.
No, see what
the point is. Oh, there's 2/3, I guess, as well.
See, this term is negligible in the inflationary period, but it is not negligible in the radiation dominated period. So, actually, let me see. So it's 3/5.
Okay. All right.
I think this is the fact. Okay. So now basically this is the final formula. So you can say, assume you know initial conditions for phi, then you know the final answer. And so now we can turn to quantum theory of cosmological perturbations. And this will not take very long. The action is a standard action of gravity. Coupled to the action of a scalar field. So what I will do is I want to linearize the equation of motion, therefore I have to expand the action to quadratic order. So I stick in the ansatz for the method. The ansatz for matter. Stick this in and expand to quadratic order. So I have S equals S naught. That's just the action for the background, for the Friedmann-Robinson-Walker background. The Friedmann-Robinson-Walker background satisfies the equation of motion. Therefore, the linear term in the action vanishes. So they're only quadratic terms. And this is what we want to calculate. And then we want to canonically quantize this action. So now, what we will do is, we will invert the usual order of proceeding. We will fix a gauge completely, and then expand. So we fix longitudinal gauge. Then the degrees of freedom we have is the metric fluctuation phi plus the matter fluctuation delta phi. This is the expanding quadratic order. So, and you know that these variables are related. They are not independent. They are related by the constraints. So therefore, without doing any calculations, you know that S2 will have this form. S2 will have the form integral d4x, no square root of minus g, d prime square minus there will be some combination of phi and delta phi, in terms of which the fluctuation, in terms of which the quadratic action has that of a free scalar field with a time-dependent mass. Without any count, this is the only answer you can get. The only thing you don't know is you don't know what is, how does V relate to the combination of phi and delta phi? And you don't know how, what is this function z? Or what is this function z over prime root z? So you don't know how the time dependence of the mass depends on background.
How do you know the you don't know the coefficient, do you, or can you absorb that?
Yes, I will define. I'm looking, there will be a V. I can, so you mean this coefficient here?
I mean the relative coefficients between the
terms. I know because it's a relativistic theorem. Mm-hmm. I work in conformally flat coordinates.
Okay.
It has to be this. The only thing I don't know is the absolute normalization. But I define my variable to absorb this absolute normalization.
Yeah.
And if I want to find out what is the absolute normalization in terms of this capital phi and delta phi, then you have to do the work. So see, what I want to stress is that in principle the procedure is extremely easy. Once we have this, we canonically quantize, we fix an initial state. The initial state is a vacuum state for each harmonic oscillator. The vacuum state with respect to the time that's set by this. Pretty straightforward, no ambiguity.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm being a bit dense. I see why the first two terms need to be what they are, and I can see it can absorb the other into V, but why can't you get some coefficient in front of the last term? Yeah.
This is the coefficient, but I call it Z double prime over Z.
Where I don't know what Z is yet.
No. Yes, that's what we have to calculate.
All right.
That's what, whatever the coefficient is, I will express it as some Z prime.
Okay.
See, I don't change notation when something is there.
Okay.
Wouldn't you want a factor of 1/2 just because V is a real?
Yes, I want 1/2. That's the reason 1/2. So now, obviously I'm not going to do the calculation for you. Because the calculation is just insertion and algebra. So the answer is that Z is A phi naught prime over H, and V, the so-called Yukanov variable, the scale factor times delta phi plus phi naught prime over A, which is So that's the answer.
So within the combination of the two, the matter and
right.
The gravitational.
And so you see that if you go to co-moving gauge, uniform field gauge, this V is the curvature perturbation. So V is related via this Z to what David Leith called R, and R is a curvature perturbation in co-moving gauge. And I would argue that since it's the curvature perturbation in co-moving gauge, in terms of which the action has this canonical form, that's the safe variable to use.
Why are we talking about changing the gauge again when we move the gauge?
No, we want to interpret this quantity. The interpretation of this quantity depends on what coordinate system you use. It's a gauge invariant variable, but from one coordinate system it looks like a matter perturbation. From a different coordinate system it looks like a curvature perturbation. You choose. Yeah, that's what.
And so at this stage, you're going to happily quantize this thing that's got this time-dependent mass, effectively.
Right.
But so Z is basically background input.
Right. Now, let me mention what happens for gravitational waves. For gravitational waves, for each helicity state, you can do the same thing here. There's no matter. So what you do for gravitational waves is you plug in the ansatz for a helicity state into this action. and you find that this V is A times the amplitude of the gravitational wave, and you will find that for gravitational waves, Z is the scale factor. So gravitational waves are amplified on scales larger than the Hubble radius. They are squeezed. Actually, the gravitational waves are not amplified on scales larger than Hubble radius, but they are squeezed. Scalar matter fluctuations are squeezed on scales larger than the Hubble radius, but by a different factor. And if you look at quantum fields, a matter scalar field on a background space-time, then Z is equal to A. So if you just do matter quantum fields on a fixed background space-time, it's like you were studying gravitational waves.
So just to clarify, both the plus and cross polarizations have that action where Z is A.
That's right. That's right.
So what would we get for the vector derivation?
You know, that's a good question. you get, see, there's something about vector derivations which I don't understand. Because you actually don't get quadratic equations. You don't get second order equations, you get first order equations. Which looks like they don't really have independent dynamics.
So they don't occur in the S2?
It means that S2 will effectively be linear. Sorry, what will happen? They have a very different form. The S2 will have a different form. So you know, that's an excellent question, and I mean, really, there's something about vector motivations which I don't understand. So you see, when I've said that the standard law is just to neglect vector motivations decay, I'm a little bit uneasy about it. I'm making that statement. Everyone else makes that statement. But I'm a little bit worried, and you... Well, I gave you the flux argument. Vector motivations correspond like magnetic flux in expanding universe, but the flux is diluted. You know, I don't accept the argument, but that's the argument that's made.
But if for some reason it were to be amplified by some non-standard extra physics, what would be the experimental signature?
Oh, the microwave, the Doppler peaks would be very, very different. In fact, one of the reasons why topological defect models are ruled out is that for topological defects, you create vector modes and tensor modes which are as important as the scalar modes. And that totally messes up the structure of the microwave, the power spectrum of the microwave ensembles. So it's definitely an observable signature.
So about this argument concerning the fluxes, what I don't understand is those vector perturbations are some components of the metric perturbations. So usually when you say flux is conserved, it's because there's something that's some charge that is conserved. So what is in this argument, what is that charge?
Again, I'd like to know the answer. I've asked the same question. I think it has one way to create such a charge is by magnetic field. But I'd like to understand that better.
But these are fluctuations of the metric. I just can't understand.
But again, they are coupled to matter. They're coupled to matter. But the honest answer is that I don't know. That's the honest answer. I would like to know. I haven't thought that.
Is it the flux? I mean, you assume that there's something like the Maxwell equation, the Gauss law, or something.
Yeah. Right. So see, but I admit my understanding of vector modes is incomplete. I've tried to argue why people tend to neglect them, and you see the holes in the argument.
From a strictly observational point of view, no one's ever seen a zero plus scalar field, whereas we know gauge fields exist full time.
Yeah, but I argued before that gauge fields induce scalar matter fluctuations.
Then what?
Gauge fields induce scalar matter fluctuations. Fermion fields do as well. Because anything that creates energy density induces a scalar gravitational moment. So the fact that no one has ever seen a scalar matter field doesn't mean that scalar matter fluctuations are not important.
No, but you just said that the vector modes in the genome have to couple to.
I'm saying that.
To couple to vector
field. That's what I'm saying, that if you want to excite a vector mode, you can do it with the scalar field. But vector fields can excite both scalar modes And I think vector modes.
Two different but related questions. Well, three maybe. The V there is not the V of phi.
No, this is
right, obviously. So yeah, what happened to the V of phi in this second order action? Why has it?
It returns the background.
So it's all lumped into
it's
Z dot?
It's all lumped into Z.
Okay. What happens if you put a cosmological constant into this? Because that lumped into Z as well?
Yes.
Surely.
Sorry. I pass on that question. I have to think about it. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
So the V's on the left side of the board are different from the V's on the right side of the board?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's,
this is
that's
the potential,
and that's another variable.
Yeah.
This is the variable, which is a combination of the matter perturbation and the metric perturbation.
Okay, and that's also what we have in the integral above.
Let the entire sum total to this order of the potential enters into Z double prime over Z, except for maybe if there's a cosmological thing.
So did I get that right? In order to explain a quantum origin of perturbations in the same V, we would not need to start with a scalar field. We could do that with vectors or spaces. The only reason why we use a scalar field is because it could have a vector expectation value in the right equation to space. But that's not because we have that.
Absolutely.
And if you non-minimally couple, what happens to this? I know that's a nasty question, but if you non-minimally couple, you have a scalar coupled to the curvature itself. Still lumped into there? Okay.
I'm quite confident about that. Okay,
is that,
so.
Is that D for X, D eta, D cubed X?
Yeah. That's all. D for X is D eta to D for X. Okay, so now what you do is canonical quantization. Once you have this action, then the action gives you the equation of motion. So I'll write that down because that's important. So canonical quantization. Where the Hamilton, and you see that I've chosen a particular time. The particular time is set by the background. And then, initial state choice. And what we say, we fix an initial time, Ti, and we demand mode by mode the vacuum state.
Oops. Is that, I guess that's a reasonable thing to do, but why did that choose?
Good question. The way that I would answer it is that if you start out with a state that has classical excitations around this state, the classical excitations will eventually fade away.
Okay.
If you don't have
it, matter, yeah.
If you don't, so this state is actually a local attractor. It's called a bunch of things back. So in that case, you then the amplitude.
So really, if I started with any of the state?
No, not any. It's a local attractor.
Oh, so it has to be sufficiently close.
It has to be sufficiently close. Because you remember that you might have heard of the alpha vacuum.
Yeah.
Those are different attractor bases. I'm going to take.
Yeah, but
it's a harmonic oscillator. Mode by mode, I'll say it's a usual harmonic oscillator ground state. Namely, Vk of Ti is given by 1 over square root of 2 omega k of ti, where omega k is the frequency you read off from this action, and vk prime of ti is 1 over square root of 2 square root of omega k. So now we have the initial conditions for the fluctuations. We can calculate how they evolve. And obviously, the quantum analysis now is completely equivalent to the classical analysis. All that we know is initial conditions. And so we finish. quantum theory of cosmological relations.
So what do you gain then by doing the quantum theory as opposed to what do you gain by doing the quantum
theory? Initial conditions.
You mean justifying that whatever you choose goes into that state?
Yeah, you basically just from a classical analysis, what should you choose as phi of TI?
Well, is there some analogous statement to the fact that that's sort of like after the quantum treatment to the fact that
we would not get the amplitude. We would never get the amplitude of phi sub I. We could get the relative amplitudes of different Fourier models, but not the absolute amplitude. For the absolute amplitude, we need if we have in mind quantum vacuum initial conditions, so it's the amplitude of the initial fluctuations. Otherwise, we don't get anything. Because we can't get anything if we linearize the equations. The only quantum mechanics is just finding initial conditions.
So the quantum mechanic basically is just in the choice of the initial state,
right.
Knowing the dynamics
right.
In such a way.
Right.
Well, but isn't it that solely quantum mechanics, you were mentioning it when you said that the scale of it we get right, essentially that's because of the computational relations, right?
Yes.
So the computational relations enforce that there are factors. Classically, you could go the way with having none.
What you mean it's H rod?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's H rod.
Oh, so it's just introducing an extra scale? Is that what you're saying?
Isn't this?
Is this all the quantum mechanics is doing?
Well, I would say it's
introducing H.
What you're taking is
fluctuations.
See, from a classical perspective, you could argue that you have inflation. Inflation eliminates all classical fluctuations. You are left with phi equals zero as your initial state. Phi equals zero. Well, quantum mechanics says that you always have these quantum fluctuations, and therefore phi initially is not equal to zero.
So all of this is just taking into account a certain difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that? That equation can't be taken literally. It means something like the you choose randomly a b which is of that standard deviation or something. Is that what it means? Or do you literally mean, I mean, why isn't it minus 1 over 2 omega k?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think you have a Gaussian wave function, and I'm taking the amplitude of that Gaussian wave function to stick it in your classical equations.
Sorry,
I didn't hear that. Yeah, I'm just confused as well about the choice of those v's of t of I.
What have I done here?
Yeah.
For the harmonic oscillator, what I've taken is I've taken the width of the wave packet of the vacuum state, and I've said that the width of the wave packet of the vacuum state is the classical initial condition. More roughly, I'm saying that I could have started with any, what I really have is a Gaussian distribution with the width of that value. And in fact, that's what this quantum theory predicts. It predicts that you have Gaussian fluctuations. It's exactly because of this quantum theory.
You mean you put it back down, or to what extent the Gaussian is this prediction? I mean, it's not you put it in by the initial choice of
not if I say that I have a vacuum, then the wave function has a Gaussian distribution about its mean. So Gaussianity is a prediction, but that prediction depends on having chosen the vacuum state. So if you choose an initial state which is absolutely non-Gaussian, then you will predict classical fluctuations, which are non-Gaussian distributions.
Right, and the fact that it's an attractor means that if it's close enough to a Gaussian, then on the side it will be washed.
Yeah. But it's always only redshifting. So you see, you always have, because it's all that happens in the distribution, the k is redshifting. So you're kind of making this attractor argument, you're assuming that everything that comes into the system from the ultraviolet is Gaussian distributed, has no ambiguity. That's a transplanting problem for inflation cosmology.
Doesn't finite energy guarantee, finite energy density, something like that, won't that guarantee that?
It may, but I'd like to see it work out. This question has not been answered. This is something that we are working on.
But Robert, Gaussianity translates one-to-one into the requirement that four-point functions and other n-point functions can be directly derived from two-point functions.
That's right.
But this would depend only on the equations of motion being linear. In other words, it's a free quantum field theory. So it would not seem to be dependent on the translation.
No, it's only for the vacuum state. So, I mean, you better than
yes, but for every vacuum state, you choose.
What do you mean every vacuum state? No, I mean,
whatever choice you make for the vacuum.
It's a boundary condition issue.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But are you saying that if you choose the vacuum, non-trivially...
No, if I choose a state which is not a vacuum state.
Yeah, but that just amounts to say I choose something else for my definition of the vacuum. I choose a different classical solution to define my quantum field.
No, you have... With different frames, you can define different vacuum states. But I can define a state which is no frames with a vacuum state. And those states will have non-Gaussian distributions. In fact, I can give you references to people who have studied the non-Gaussianity induced by non-trivial initial states.
So that would be states that cannot be viewed as vacuum, what boundary conditions to choose.
But let me just try to summarize anything that I've said today. So see, most of my time was spent on number one and number two, the simplification of the problem. By the classification of the metric fluctuations and the elimination of degrees of freedom. Then we get classical equations of motion, but we can also do the quantum theory. The quantum theory is true. So, it's no mystery that occurs. So, I think this is actually what I plan to say about. This completes the lecture series that I planned on the theory of on inflation and the theory of cosmological relations. And I know that quite a few of you are disappearing for Marseille next week, so maybe next week I could speak about brain gas cosmology or something like that, if that's interesting.
I'm interested, unfortunately.
Oh, you're not here either, but anyway, we're waiting here. So I would say the Cosmo course is probably finished, and there could always be seminars now.
Thank you.